We're in the final stretch this week, so if you would turn in your Bibles to Genesis 49, verse 28 is where we're going to start. All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with the blessing that was suitable to him. Then he commanded them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites. When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into his bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Then Joseph fell on his father's face and wept over him and kissed him. And Joseph commanded his servants, the physicians, to embalm his father. So the physicians embalmed Israel. 40 days were required for it, for that is how many are required for embalming. And the Egyptians wept for him 70 days. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, If now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, My father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. In my tomb that I have hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there shall you bury me. Now, therefore, let me please go up and bury my father. Then I will return. And Pharaoh answered, Go up and bury your father as he has made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. When they came to the threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, This is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Therefore, the place was named Abel Mizraim. It is beyond the Jordan. Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field of at Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his father. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him. So they sent a message to Joseph saying, Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, Please forgive the transgressions of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now, please forgive the transgressions of the servants of the God of your father. Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, Behold, we are your servants. But Joseph said to them, Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones. Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house. Joseph lived 110 years, and Joseph saw Ephraim's children to the third generation. The children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die. But God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God will surely visit you, and you shall carry up my bones from here. So Joseph died, being 110 years old, They embalmed him, and they put him in a coffin in Egypt.
Thanks, Tracy. Well, this morning, we finally land our plane in our series in Genesis. We began the series May 8th of last year, 2022. And the first Sunday in April, we're going to be finishing up our sermon series in Genesis. And I don't know about you, but like, what a journey this has been. 50 chapters, and we've covered a lot. From God creating the universe to the garden and fall of Adam and Eve, to the spread of sin over the world, to God flooding the earth in judgment, to God preserving the earth through Noah and the ark, to God calling Abraham and promising him a multitude of descendants and that he was going to give him a great land of his own and promise him blessing, to these promises being passed down to Abraham and then from Abraham to Isaac and from Isaac to Jacob and then finally from Jacob to Jacob's 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel. So we've covered a whole lot. And through all of this, we've seen, if you've been with us for any length of time, certain themes, certain patterns that are replayed over and over again throughout this book. Like the scene of the garden being replayed over and over again throughout this book of one person after another who saw something that was enticing to their eyes and then they took it to indulge themselves just like Eve in the garden. Or the theme of decreation and recreation, or the theme of offspring and land and blessing, or the theme of exile and the theme of Exodus, or the themes of favoritism and deception and the older brother being passed over in favor of the younger brother. Or we've also seen all of these different ways in which Genesis foreshadows and how it points forward to the true and better Adam, the true and better Noah, the true and better Abraham, the true and better Isaac, the true and better Jacob, and none other than the person of Jesus. And the whole point, maybe not the whole point, but one of the reasons, one of the points that we wanted you, that we wanted to make our way through Genesis, is for us to be able to see just this story and to show you how Genesis just isn't the beginning of the story of the Bible. Instead, Genesis is the story of the Bible. It's just replayed and repeated over and over again in greater fulfillment throughout the rest of the 65 books of the Bible. But as we come to this last and final sermon and passage in the book of Genesis, here's the question I want us to conclude our sermon series in the book of Genesis with. And the question is this: what effect is this book, these 50 chapters, this book, what effect should this book and everything that we've seen in this book have on our lives after we're done with it? Like, that's the question. Like, what effect, a year later, 50 chapters later, should we leave this sermon series with after we've concluded it? And so here's the caution, and here's even my concern. Like, all of these recurring themes we've seen, and these recurring patterns we've seen, and all these different hyperlinks we've seen, all throughout the book of Genesis, are really cool. Right? They're like really cool. They're awesome. And they are, yes. So don't misunderstand me. They're important to catch and to see in order for us to understand the overarching storyline and story of the Bible. And so, like, yes and amen to all of that. At the same time, what effect should all of that have on our lives? Like, practically, personally, after we've seen all this and after we're done with all this. Because I don't know about you, but it would be like a shame to spend a year in this book, 50 chapters in this book, and miss the effect that this book is to have on our lives. And so then what's that effect? What effect should this book have on our lives after we're done with it? Well, that's what we're going to see in our passage here this morning. that as we come to the conclusion of this year-long journey through the book of Genesis, we're going to see within our passage of how this whole book concludes, we're going to be reminded and see two major effects, two primary effects, not the only effects, but two of the major primary effects that the book of Genesis should have on our lives after we're done. That as we're walking away, that we should have a greater blank, which we're about to see, than we did on May 8th when we began this series. That's the effect should have on our lives. So what are those effects? Well, effect number one should be, hopefully, is this. You see it on the top of your handout there. Is that after we're done with this book, Genesis should increase our trust in God's promises. That's the first effect. It should increase our trust, our faith, our confidence, our belief in God's promises. And hopefully, if you've been in this series for any length of time, you hear that effect, and hopefully that isn't new for you. Hopefully you've seen that pattern repeated all throughout this book over and over again. But this is how Genesis ends. It ends with this big exclamation point that reminds us that God is faithful and that we can trust Him and that we should be confident that He's going to do absolutely everything that He said He's going to do and everything that He's promised. And we see this right from the get-go here in verse 28 of chapter 49. Look there with me at verse 28. It says, "All these are the 12 tribes of Israel. This is what their father," referring to Jacob here, "said to them as he blessed them, blessing each with a blessing suitable to him." And so what this is a reference to is what we saw last week at the beginning of chapter 49 through verse 1 of chapter 49 through verse 27 there. If you remember there, Jacob blessed his 12 sons, which if you remember is different than what Abraham and Isaac did. If you remember going all the way back to Genesis chapter 12, God made a pretty big promise to Abraham. He promised him three things: a multitude of descendants, a special land of his own for those descendants, and blessing. Abraham then passed down those promises and blessings to one particular son of his, Isaac. And then Isaac passed down those promises and blessings to one particular son of his, Jacob. But then Jacob here doesn't pass down these promises and blessings to just one particular son of his. He passes them down to all of his sons, to all 12 of them. So then they all 12 of his sons as a whole, all the 12 sons, all the 12 tribes together, Israel as a whole receives the promise of offspring and land and blessing. After he blesses his sons then, Jacob makes one request. He has one request for his sons. He asks them to do one thing for him. And we see what he asked him to do, what he asked them to do there in verse 29. Look there with me. "Then he," talking about Jacob, "commanded them," his sons, "and said to them," here's his one request, "I am to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the land of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, to the east of Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron the Hittite to possess as a burying place. There they buried Abraham and Sarah his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah his wife, and there I buried Leah. The field and the cave that is in it were bought from the Hittites." Verse 33. "When Jacob finished commanding his sons, he drew up his feet into the bed, and he breathed his last and was gathered to his people." In other words, end of verse 33 ends with Jacob dying. But before he dies, did you notice what he did? His one request to his sons before he dies is that he asks them, he tells them, he commands them to bury him in the same cave that Abraham and Isaac and their wives and his wife Leah are buried in, which is a cave, if you remember, in the land of Canaan. But that's not where Jacob and his 12 sons are right now. Where are they? They're in Egypt. But that's not where Jacob wants to be buried. He doesn't want to be buried in Egypt. He wants to be buried in Canaan. And so then he commands his 12 sons to make sure that they bury him there in Canaan. And so then when we flip to the next chapter, in chapter 50, that's exactly what they do. In verses 1 through 3 of chapter 50, his sons grieve, they weep over Jacob's death, and then they embalm Jacob's body so that they can preserve it for their journey back to Canaan. And then in verse 4, Joseph then goes to Pharaoh and asks Pharaoh for permission for he and his other brothers to take Jacob's body to Canaan so that they can bury it. So think about this, right? They're not going anywhere without Pharaoh's permission. If Pharaoh doesn't nod his head and say, yeah, you can go, they're not going. And so Joseph has to go to Pharaoh to get Pharaoh's permission in order for Pharaoh to allow them to take their father's dead body and take it to Canaan to bury it in Canaan. And that's what we see in verse 4. Look at verse 4. And when the days of weeping for him were past, Joseph spoke to the household of Pharaoh, saying, if now I have found favor in your eyes, please speak in the ears of Pharaoh, saying, my father made me swear, saying, I am about to die. In my tomb that I hewed out for myself in the land of Canaan, there shall you bury me. Now therefore, let me go up and bury my father, then I will return. And Pharaoh answered, go up and bury your father as he made you swear. So Joseph went up to bury his father, and look at everybody who went with him. With him went up all the servants of Pharaoh, the elders of his household, and all the elders of the land of Egypt, as well as all the household of Joseph, his brothers, and his father's household. Only their children, their flocks, and their herds were left in the land of Goshen. And there went up with him both chariots and horsemen. It was a very great company. Like the understatement of the year. Like this was a massive entourage. You ever seen a funeral procession? This is a humongous funeral procession. She included Joseph, his brothers, his family, but also included all these high-ranking Egyptian officials, all these elders in the land of Egypt, which signified what? It signified how important that Jacob was. He was the father of the second most powerful person in Egypt. And so he had a massive entourage that escorted him to his funeral, to his burial in Canaan. Then look at verse 10. When they came to the fresh threshing floor of Atad, which is beyond the Jordan, meaning they're in Canaan now, they lamented there with a very great and grievous lamentation. And he made a mourning for his father 7 days. When the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites, saw the mourning on the threshing floor of Atad, they said, This is a grievous mourning by the Egyptians. Therefore, the place was named Abel Mizraim, which means in your footnote there, the mourning of the Egyptians. Then verse 11 goes on, it is beyond the Jordan. And so just notice the picture here. The Egyptians, along with Joseph and his brothers and his family, they're weeping, like they're wailing as they're bringing Jacob's body into the land of Canaan and as they're getting ready to bury him. And this wasn't just a soft little cry. These weren't just soft little sniffles. Instead, this is weeping. This is wailing, like really, really loud. Then look at verse 12. Thus his sons did for him as he had commanded them. For his sons carried him to the land of Canaan and buried him in the cave of the field at Machpelah to the east of Mamre, which Abraham bought with the field from Ephron, the Hittite, to possess as a burying place. After he had buried his father, Joseph returned to Egypt with his brothers and all who had gone up with him to bury his fathers. So then, in other words, Jacob's sons do exactly what Jacob commanded them to do at the very end of chapter 49. They bring his body out of Egypt and bury him in Canaan, in the field, in the cave, where the rest of his family are buried. But there's something important here that we don't miss, that's going on here, that's even bigger than just Joseph and his brothers burying Jacob's body in Canaan. That Jacob's body here being brought out of Egypt into the land of promise, the land of Canaan, it foreshadows an even bigger and greater event that's still yet to come. It foreshadows the Exodus and how 40 plus years later, God's going to come and rescue the nation of Israel from their bondage in Egypt, and He's going to bring them up into the land that God has promised them, the land of Canaan. And so then this is how our passage this morning begins. It begins with Jacob dying, asking to be buried in the land of Canaan, and his sons bringing him up out of Egypt into Canaan, shadowing then the Exodus that's still yet to come. Remember that. Now we're going to skip over some verses and come back to them here in just a moment. But I want you to see if that's how the passage begins. Now I want you to see how the passage ends and how Genesis ends. And it ends in verse 22. Look there with me. Verse 22, chapter 50. What happens here takes place about 60 years after Jacob died and after he was buried in the land of Canaan. Verse 22. So Joseph remained in Egypt, he and his father's house, meaning all his brothers, and Joseph lived 110 years. So they're back in Egypt now. And Joseph saw Ephraim's children of the third generation, the children also of Machir, the son of Manasseh, were counted as Joseph's own. So if you remember, Ephraim and Manasseh were Joseph's children. And so Joseph here lived long enough to see his great-grandchildren. Then look what Joseph told his brothers then in verse 24. And Joseph said to his brothers, I am about to die, but God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that He swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. So then here we go again. Joseph, just like Jacob earlier, is about to die. But before he dies, he wants his brothers to know that God is going to come and visit them and rescue them out of Egypt and bring them back into the land that God had promised them, that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and to Jacob, which is none other than the land of Canaan, which is, again, a reference to the Exodus that is still yet to come. But the point that we need to see here is that Jacob here, he's sure about this. He's confident. He's certain that this is going to happen. That's why he says in verse 24, he says, God will visit you and bring you up out of this land to the land that He swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. The key word here is will. God will do this. But in promising this to his brothers, he wants the brothers to promise him something in return. He makes a promise to them. God will bring you out of Egypt to the promised land. But in light of my promise to you, I want you to make a promise to me. And here's the promise that he wants his brothers to make to him. Look at verse 25. Then Joseph made the sons of Israel swear. Here's the promise. Saying, God will surely visit you. So that's the promise he made to them. And when he does, then here's the promise he wants them to make to him. And you shall carry up my bones from here. In other words, when God comes and visits you, when he comes to bring you out of Egypt back to Canaan, then promise me that when he does that, that you're going to take my dead body with you, my bones with you, when you go back to Canaan, and bury them there. In other words, don't bury me here in Egypt. Take me, take my bones back with you to the land of Canaan and bury them alongside Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Then hear the very last words in Genesis, verse 26. So Joseph died, being 110 years old. They embalmed him and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. In other words, they embalm his body in order to what? To preserve his body for whenever God finally comes to visit them so that they can take him back to the promised land of Canaan. In other words, their embalming of Joseph's body and putting him into a coffin like this is a demonstration of their faith. It's a demonstration that they believe that God is going to come and visit them, bring them out of Egypt, and take them back to the promised land. And so they want to preserve Joseph's body for that day so they can take him and bury him in the land of Canaan, just like God, just like he wanted them to promise. And so then, that's the end of Genesis. That's it. It began with a life, with life, in a beautiful garden. And it ends with death in Egypt, outside of the garden, and outside of the land that God had promised. And so then at first glance, the ending of Genesis here seems pretty anticlimactic. At first glance, the ending of Genesis here like seems like a downer. Death outside the land. Everyone's dying. God's promises haven't been fulfilled. And yeah, like that's part of it. Because that's like life outside the garden. Like this is the consequences of life outside the garden. It's death. But at the same time, Genesis just doesn't end with death. It also ends with faith. It ends with faith. Like the reason that Jacob and Joseph were so insistent that their bodies be buried in Canaan is because that's the land that God had promised them. And even though they hadn't at that point in time of their death received the fulfillment of the God that promised them, they died in faith, believing that one day they would receive the land that God had promised. So much so, when they were breathing their last breath down to the very brink of death in their life, they said, "Don't bury me in Egypt. Bury me in Canaan. Because that's the land, that's the promise, that's the fulfillment of the promise that God's ultimately going to fulfill. That's going to be our land." And so their assistance then that they be buried in Canaan was a demonstration of their faith. That one day that God was going to come and visit them and rescue them and bring them into the land that God had promised them. So then, back to the original question. What effect should any of this and the reality of everything we've just seen this morning and really leading up to this morning in our passage in Genesis have on our lives? Like, how is any of this relevant for us? What effect should dead bodies being buried in Canaan in the strip of land in the Middle East have on you? Have on me? Have on our lives today? Well, in order to answer that question, we have to remember the story of Genesis that we've been walking through through the last year. If you remember, this story began. Where did it begin? It began when God's people, Adam and Eve, in God's place, the Garden of Eden, under God's rule and reign, enjoying God's blessing. That's where it began. But then they sinned and they rebelled against God's rule, and as a result, they were exiled out of God's place, and therefore they forfeited God's blessing. In God's grace, though, He raised up a man by the name of Abraham, and He made him some really important promises. And He promised that a great nation was going to come from him, and that nation was going to become God's people, Israel. And they were going to live in God's place, the promised land of Canaan, in God's presence, under God's rule and reign, enjoying God's blessing. In other words, just put this together. Canaan was going to become the new Eden. Canaan was Eden 2.0. And so then this is the promise that Jacob and Joseph and his brothers were believing, that they were banking everything on when they were about to die in Egypt. They were believing that God was going to bring His people, Israel, into God's place, Canaan, and they were going to live under God's rule and enjoy His blessings forever. But as we've talked about through this series, this promise that God made to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob and to Jacob's sons, this promise was to be fulfilled in two levels or two stages. First, it was to be fulfilled in God's people Israel, living in God's place Canaan, as they lived under God's rule and enjoyed God's blessing, just like we've talked about. But, and here's the important point, that's not the ultimate fulfillment of this promise. The full and ultimate fulfillment of this promise is when God's people, the church, us, live in God's place, the new creation that's to come when Jesus returns, under God's rule and enjoying God's blessing forever and ever and ever and ever and ever and ever. In other words, the land of Canaan that God promised to Israel was just a snapshot. It was just an appetizer. It was just a little preview that pointed forward to the greater and more ultimate land that God has promised, namely the land of the new creation that is to come when Jesus returns. And so then in light of knowing all of that in this story, right, you can see now how this passage is relevant for our lives today as Christians. It's relevant because just like Jacob and just like Joseph and his brothers were waiting on God to come and visit them, they were waiting on the Exodus that was to come when God came to rescue them out of Egypt and bring them into the land that God had promised them, Canaan. So then as God's people today, we, the church, we're waiting on God too. We're trusting that God's going to come too. We're waiting on a new and a greater exodus that's to come when God comes and visits us and delivers us and brings us out of this world into the land that Canaan was ultimately pointing to, the land of the new creation, the new heavens and the new earth that's to come. And so then as Christians, this is what we're believing and banking everything on, right? Like everything. Like, I don't know about you, but like life outside of the garden, like life in Egypt, life outside of God's place, that's where we are right now. And it's hard. Like it's really hard and painful and difficult. And we feel it all around us. We see it all around us. From funerals this week to school shootings this week. And we feel it inside of us. In the fear and the anxiety and the stress and the sorrow and the grief and the sin and the temptation. Life outside of the garden is hard. And we've seen this all throughout the book of Genesis. Like ever since chapter 3, we've seen death and murder and floods and famines and deception and lies and manipulation and family turmoil and dysfunction and fear and selfishness and self-worship and sexual immorality and false accusations and on and on and on and on. Like that's what life is like outside of God's place. And we're experiencing that. We feel that. And we can all relate to that. And so many in our church are just right now, like even this morning, confronted with the reality of death. So many walking through relational pain and turmoil and dysfunction and conflict. So many walking through and experiencing just unrelenting, ongoing physical pain and health issues that never stop. So many battling temptation and sin and just having to walk through and endure the consequences of sin in your life. So many struggle with fear, anxiety, depression, stress. And you're exhausted. You're tired. And as you think about having to continue on with all of this for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 more years, you're like, I don't know if I can do that. And like, if that's you this morning, if you're thinking, if you're weary, if you're tired, you're like, I don't know if I can keep on keeping on and endure and continue to walk through this in my life, then hear the promise that Joseph reminded his brothers of. God will surely visit you. Not just them, but you. He's going to come and visit you and bring you up out of this land, this world, this earth, to the land that He swore to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which is ultimately fulfilled in the new creation to come. And so then I know like things are hard. I know things are difficult and excruciating, painful in 100 different ways. But don't give up. Endure. Persevere. Like there's coming a day in which God's going to come in the person of His Son Jesus and visit you. And the greater, more ultimate exodus is going to occur as He rescues you and rescues me and delivers us out of exile in this broken world, in Egypt, in exile outside of Canaan, and bring us to the land that He's ultimately promised, which is His place, in His presence, under His rule, enjoying His blessing forever. So that's the first effect Genesis is to have on our lives. It's to increase our hope, our faith, our confidence in these promises, in this land that He has promised to us. The second effect then, this can be much shorter, Genesis to have on our lives then is this. The second effect, you see it on your handout there, is that Genesis should increase our trust in God's sovereignty. Should increase our trust in God's sovereignty. Like this is the point of the verses that we skipped over just a minute ago. So look at verse 15 through verse 21 with me there in chapter 50. Remember the context real quick. Joseph and his brothers have just returned back to Egypt after burying their father Jacob in Canaan. And once they get back to Egypt, here's what happens next in verse 15. Look there with me. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." So do you see what's going on here? Joseph's brothers are scared out of their mind. They believe that the only reason Joseph hasn't paid them back for the evil that they've done to him up to this point is because their father has been alive. And Joseph didn't want to offend and upset his father. But now, since Jacob, their father, is dead, they're afraid for their lives. And now they're afraid that since their father is dead, that Joseph's now going to get back at them and pay them back for the evil that they committed against him when they sold him off into slavery. But that's not what Joseph does. Instead, look at how Joseph responds to his brothers in verse 19. "But Joseph said to them, 'Do not fear.'" Meaning, you don't need to be afraid of me. There's nothing to be afraid of. I'm not going to pay you back. I'm not going to get back at you. I'm not going to harm you. You don't need to be afraid of me and what I'm going to do to you. And here's why. Joseph says, "For am I in the place of God?" In other words, I'm not going to pay you back. I'm not going to get back at you. I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to punish you because I'm not God. And since I'm not God, I don't have the right to get back at you and punish you and pay you back and for what you did to me. I'm not God. That's His right. That's not me, my right, but I'm not Him. Which is the exact opposite of what we saw at the very beginning of Genesis in the garden, isn't it? You remember what happened there? That the serpent tells Adam and Eve that if they eat of the fruit in the garden, then what? They'll be like God. And so then they ate of the fruit so that they would be like God. But when Joseph here is faced with the same temptation, he resists because he knows that he's not God. That's not his right. And so he doesn't seek to be like God, like Adam and Eve did. Then look at what look what he tells his brothers then in verse 20. As for you, brothers, you meant evil against me for selling me off into slavery, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. And so then I know we've talked about this verse before here, but it's important again to notice what Joseph isn't saying here. He's not saying, you guys did evil against me, and God just swooped down and He turned your evil into good. He made lemonade out of lemons. That's not what Joseph is saying here. Instead, what Joseph is saying is that when you were doing evil against me, God was using those evil acts you were doing to accomplish something good. Or more specifically, if Joseph's brothers hadn't sold Joseph to the Ishmaelite traders that were passing by the pit, then Joseph would have never ended up in Egypt. And if Joseph wouldn't have ever ended up in Egypt, then he wouldn't have ever interpreted the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker in prison. And if he had never interpreted the dreams of the cupbearer and the baker in prison, he wouldn't have ever interpreted Pharaoh's dream. And if he had never interpreted Pharaoh's dream, then he would never have become the second in command in Egypt. And if he would never have ended up as the second in command in Egypt, then many people would have died in the famine. And so then Joseph's brothers, what they did to him, they're responsible for. They did it. They did great evil against him. But their sin, their evil that they committed against him was the means, was the vehicle that God used to keep a whole bunch of people alive during the famine and in order to save them. And as Christians, like we understand this, right? Like this is exactly what happened to Jesus on the cross. Like those who killed Jesus meant it for evil. They hated him. They wanted to kill him. They wanted him dead. And so they killed him. But God used their murder of Jesus as the means by which He saved many lives from the judgment that we deserve for our sin. That God didn't just turn their murder of Jesus into good. Their murder of Jesus was the means by which God saved our lives as Christians from the judgment that we deserve for our sin. And God's doing the same thing when it comes to Joseph and his brothers. And Joseph recognized this. He recognized how God sovereignly used his brothers' evil for good, and how his brothers' evil didn't hinder or thwart the fulfillment of God's promises, but instead their evil was the vehicle and the means by which God's promises were fulfilled. But again, the main point we need to see here is how this is the exact opposite of what happened in the garden at the very beginning of Genesis. That in the garden, Adam and Eve ate the fruit because they wanted to be like God, knowing good and what? Knowing good and evil, just like here. And their desire to be like God, knowing good and evil, brought about what? It brought about death. But here, when we get to the very end of Genesis, we have the Garden 2.0 replayed all over again. But here, Joseph is the opposite of Adam. He's the anti-Adam. He resists the temptation to play the role of God and instead recognizes that God is the one who is sovereign over good and evil. And that God is the one who uses evil to bring about good to save many people's lives. And for us as Christians today, like this right here is our hope. Like throughout Genesis, we've seen all these different threats to God's promises. All these different things that sought to thwart God's promises. All these different things that sought to thwart God's promises of God's people being in God's place, enjoying God's blessing under God's rule. If you remember, there was the threat of Sarah's barrenness. There was the threat of Pharaoh taking Sarah into his harem. There was the threat of Laban keeping Jacob and not letting him go back to Canaan. There was the threat of famines, the threat of imprisonments, the threat of being placed into a pit, the threat of being sold into slavery, the threat of the potential sacrifice of Isaac. There was the threat of sons deceiving their father. All of these things were threats that sought to thwart the promises that God had made of God's people being in God's place, enjoying God's blessing. But guess what? None of these things, none of them could ultimately hinder and thwart God's promises from being fulfilled. And do you know why? Because God's sovereign. He's in control. He's sovereign over everything, including evil. He's not the author of evil. He doesn't do evil, but He is sovereign over evil. And He can even use evil as the means and vehicle by which His promises are fulfilled. And since He can do that, His promises then are unstoppable. Nothing can stop them. Death can't stop them. Sin can't stop them. Selling brothers into slavery can't stop them. Evil can't stop them. You want to try and stop God's promises? He'll just use them to fulfill His promises. Ha! You can't stop it. It's invincible, unstoppable. It's in this way then that the sovereignty, make the connection, the sovereignty of God guarantees the fulfillment of the promises of God. Like I can make my kids' promises all day long. Hey, I'll come get you at school at 3:20. There's no guarantee that I can fulfill that promise. What if I'm in a car wreck? What if there's an accident along the way? What if there's a red light that makes me sit there for 25 minutes? What if I can't change any of that because I'm not sovereign. But God is sovereign. And He can twist and turn and change and use and all of those things in order to fulfill His promise. The promises that He's made. The sovereignty of God guarantees and gives us rock solid confidence in the fulfillment of the promises of God. And because of that then, we can be confident and sure that one day we as God's people, meaning those from every tongue and tribe and nation who have trusted in Jesus by faith, those who have believed that Jesus is the serpent crusher that was promised in Genesis 3:15, and that Jesus was the true and better Adam who resisted Satan's temptation, and who believe that Jesus is the true and better Abraham who went to a foreign land to form a great nation, and that He's the true and better Isaac who wasn't just offered up on a mountain but was sacrificed as a substitutionary sacrifice for all of us, and who believe that Jesus was the true and better Jacob who wrestled and is wounded by God in our place, and that Jesus is the true and better Joseph who is delivered from death and raised up to live alive, and who believes all of these things, that if you believe that, then you're part of God's people that God had promised going all the way back to Genesis 12. And you can be confident and sure then that we then as God's people will one day be brought to God's place. Like growing up, I used to think that after we died, we went to heaven and spent the rest of eternity as these disembodied spirits floating on a cloud, playing a harp for all of eternity. And I'll be like honest, that didn't interest me a whole lot. Like, boring, right? Thankfully, that's not what the Bible teaches. Like, don't misunderstand me. Yes, if you're a Christian, after you die, your spirit goes to heaven while your dead physical body stays in the grave. But when Jesus returns back, your dead physical body is going to be raised back to life, reunited with your soul, and instead of living as a disembodied spirit on a cloud in heaven, you're going to live in a physical body in a real physical land here in a perfectly restored earth known as the new creation for the rest of forever and ever and ever and ever. It's in this way then that yes, when we die, we do go up to heaven, but when we're raised, heaven comes down to earth and completely transforms this earth into a new creation. And when that happens, then we as God's people will live in God's place under God's rule, just as God had originally intended in the garden. At that point in time, everything will be at rest. There will finally be peace and rest on earth. The curse will have been removed. Sin and all the effects of sin will have been completely eradicated. No more sin, no more funerals, no more death, no more cancer, no more sickness, no more disease, no more school shootings, no more tears, no more grief, no more sadness, no more doctors, no more hospitals, no more physical pain, no more stress, no more anxiety, no more depression, no more relational conflict and strife. Instead, every sad thing in this world is going to become untrue. As the whole earth is at rest, living in submission to God's rule and reign once and for all. Our hearts experiencing what our hearts have always longed for. And as we as God's people live in God's place under God's rule and under God's reign, then we'll enjoy God's blessings forever and ever and ever. Perfect provision, complete satisfaction, exhilarating joy and peace, basking in the presence of Jesus. Like this right here is the story that we've been born into and that we're a part of right now. And that after 50 chapters and after a year long in this series and in this book, these are the effects that I'm praying that Genesis will have had on our lives as a church. That we would leave this book with a rock solid confidence and assurance in these promises. And the reason we can be so sure of them is because God is sovereign. And since He's sovereign, we know that nothing can stop these promises and thwart and hinder God from fulfilling these promises of we as God's people, living in God's place, under God's gracious and kind rule and reign, in His presence, enjoying His blessings forever and ever and ever. Let's pray together. Lord, thank You for this series. Thank You for the last year. Thank You for these 50 chapters and all that we've seen. And God, I pray that You would work the effect of this series deep into our hearts, that we would leave here with a better understanding of the story that we're a part of. And the reality of that would give us a greater confidence and assurance as Your people regarding Your place and Your reign and Your blessings that we partially get to experience and know in the here and now, but that we will finally and fully and ultimately experience when Jesus returns. Lord, help us to long for that day. Help us to live for that day, the day that You come and visit us and we experience the ultimate exodus out of this world to the ultimate land that we've been promised. And we pray all these things in Jesus' name. Amen.